Morning. Please take a moment to feel any pain, sore spots. Maybe you can massage it. Release some of the pressure, tension. As we give ourselves to the practice, allow the things going on in our head, allow that energy to just naturally drift down where it belongs, and let it settle in the center, physical center of our body, below our navel, below our belly button. No before or after, no better or worse, no illusion, no enlightenment, just sitting through like this, the normal sense of space and time dissolves, just kind of falls away. There is, as the Zazen manual and elsewhere explains, clarity, purity, freshness, lightness, we are no longer in our head, in our notions, our agenda, our ideas, our expectations, our memories, our desires, our greed. It is, in effect, a different world. This world is transformed. It's no longer the world in our head. The world of my agenda, my preferences, my aversions. This is more or less necessary, needed, in order to begin practice. If we don't get out of our head and centered in the physical center of our body, huh? We are subject to, a slave to, whatever ideas and moods come along. We cannot even get settled in the practice. That's precisely what a session is for. Session, the Japanese word, literally means shin is the same term for kokoro, or the heart or the mind. Huh? And setsu, session, the first, the setsu, which is pronounced then session, is to bring all together, a kind of concentering, all gathered into. And here the term, very general term, kokoro, the heart, the mind, the belly, place it as you will. But it is not the head. The sense of an embodied practice, not just something in your mind or in your head. This is essential to begin, really, the practice of Zazen. You see why the Zazen manual begins, the first one-third or so, is about first the body. In the very beginning, it goes on about, you know, the notion of doing it for all beings, to kind of set the tone. But then it very soon goes into what to do with the body, what to do with the legs, what to do with the hands, shoulders, nose, all this. Beginning with the body. Once the body is settled, the breath is regulated, then the more delicate, the more difficult question of how to deal with the mind. But if the body's already settled, the mind is already becoming settled, in, at least for now, in the body rather than just in the head. You know it's going well when you have a sense of beyond compare. Up here, we're always comparing and evaluating and judging. But when you're just giving all to the sitting, that itself is beyond compare. Do you understand? Beyond compare. It can't be compared to anything. It doesn't need to be. There is nothing to compare it to. It is itself beyond compare. And there is where we simply continue to give all of ourselves without need for asking when, how, where, why. Theoretical questions are of no use. They actually take us out of the practice and back into our head, huh? A world of possibilities, huh? Of theories, huh? But the question that we are can really help to ground a focus, almost like an anchor for a boat or a ship, to anchor the practice, huh? Not a question in your head, but the question of you yourself, huh? The question not just in your head, it's embodied. If you don't have that kind of a question, fine. Just give all of yourself to the practice. If there is some kind of a fundamental question or doubt, then give all of yourself to that. one of the great values of this kind of a question of doubt is to prevent you from just resting in a kind of quietness or calmness, an obvious, very common problem. When you learn how to meditate and you enter into these calm, very relaxed, fresh, open states, you want to stay there. It becomes the dark mountain cave. You see the problem, huh? It becomes an escape from the actual world. Well, we're just then creating another division, aren't we? Huh? And we're escaping from something. This is not the purpose of Zen Buddhism or of Zazen. Huh? So if you have that kind of a genuine question or doubt, it can, in a good sense, drive you further. Let that slowing down not be content with itself. Look, Ma, only 5 kilometers an hour. I can do a headstand on the train. No. But to actually, with that kind of a genuine question or doubt, it becomes clear without coming to a complete stop. Nothing is really resolved. We're still on the wheel. We're still going around. We're still causing pain to ourselves and to others. We are still not seeing what is right under our feet. And so, to let the activities of the mind come to a complete stop. This is one of the purposes of Zazen, but also of a genuine koan. Taken up in the head, of course, it just generates thoughts, right? If you think about a koan, it's useless. It's utterly useless because you're simply taking your practice and putting it up in your head and mentally masturbating about the koan. It must be done here, and it must come to contain everything. So if there is a genuine question or doubt, let it deepen your practice. If there really is no inside or outside when you're sitting deeply, if there really is no inside and outside, what is there? What is there? What is there? Are you still dreaming or not? If there really is no inside or outside, what is there? What is there? Unless it's crystal clear and razor sharp, you're probably dwelling in a dream. Beware. Before a thought arises, before mind moves, as we say, what is there? What is it? What is it? There. There is where mind must stop because it cannot go on. Before mind moves, before a thought occurs, right here, right now, when the train comes to a stop, right here, well, what is it? What is it? What do you get when you get Satori, What do you get when the train stops, What do you got? What do you got? Show it. With a single phrase, express it all. If you can't, you're not there. With a single phrase, express it all. If you can't, you're not there. one of the basic questions that Zen has come to be put in is in terms of Bodhidharma, the patriarch who brought, so to speak, Zen to China from India. So naturally, the question, the ultimate question, came to be asked in respect of Bodhidharma. What's the point of Bodhidharma coming from the West? What's the point? There are many, many wonderful answers that have been given to that question. If we are all already truly who and what we are, why did he have to make that dangerous trip? It supposedly took him a few years. Now we could do it in a few hours with a plane. What's the point of Bodhidharma coming? One answer was, if he had any point at all, he couldn't save even himself. Another response was, does anybody remember it? Another response was, after a long sitting, one feels tired. That fits for today, doesn't it? Supposedly, Bodhidharma sat for years in a cave waiting for a worthy disciple. He sat so long that his legs withered away. So to this day, if you see a snowman often in the West, there are three balls that we make a snowman of: the legs, the torso, and the head. In the Far East, it's two. He doesn't have legs. Then he's called a Yuki Daruma, a snow Bodhidharma. Daruma is the short term for Dharma. It's not called a snowman, it's a snow dharma, snow daruma. There's only two, because his legs withered away, he sat so long. Maybe this monk was a bit hung up with that. So when he asked, what's the point of Bodhidharma coming from the West? He sat for years in that cave. After a long sitting, I feel tired. What about you? It's time to return to the Zazen manual, huh? This is the most urgent task. This meaning developing the concentrated power of jhana that he was talking about in the last paragraph. This is the most urgent task. If you don't practice calmly and quietly, in the end, you will be completely lost. To search for the pearl, it's best to calm the waves with the water of concentration still and clear. The mind pearl reveals itself. So up until now, he's been rather gentle with us, but now he's coming to the conclusion, so he's pressing the buttons a little bit. This is the most urgent task. Just a little while ago, he was saying, yeah, use the wind to fan the flame. Great effort is not needed. Yeah, but at the same time, this is a most urgent task. This is none other than the great matter of life and death, of birth and death. If not, you're playing a game with yourself. This is the most urgent task. If you don't practice calmly and quietly, in the end, you'll be completely lost, like so many pseudo-Zen practitioners who sit and enter maybe some kind of a samadhi and enjoy it and talk about it and discuss koans, and then a real crisis comes. It's tragic. Or they find out they're about to die. It's tragic. And they find out all of their mental masturbation was worthless. Oh, this is the most urgent task of life and death. That's right. That's right. And yet, precisely because of that, we must practice calmly and quietly to make it clear and unmistakable. If we try to do it in a rush, in a hurry, we won't get anywhere fast. And so, the greatness of Zazen. The very posture shows that we are doing it calmly and quietly. We're not getting up and running around and scratching every itch. Then he gives the famous metaphor, which I've used in my lectures, and it's quoted elsewhere. It's very nice. To search for the pearl, you know, in the clam. On occasion, a clam gets some sand inside, and it actually irritates. That's why it ends up producing the pearl. It's based on a kind of an irritation in the clam. But to us, of course, it's a precious, it's a precious jewel. So, using that metaphor, to search for the pearl, of course, it's our pearl. We have made it. Made it. It's not made, but it's best to calm the waves. In order to search for it, in order to see clearly where and what it is, we calm the waves of the mind. Of course, that's not the end of practice, but it's a helpful beginning. If we're just following this wave and then that wave, how can we even begin? How do we even know the direction? And so, with the water of concentration still unmoving and clear, the mind pearl, what we have been seeking for so desperately, right, reveals itself. It was always already there, but if you're going at 200 kilometers an hour on the train, or if the water is all choppy and wavy, you're as good as lost. As a matter of fact, the pearl is there. And you can stop the train just like that. It's really not even moving. But to really know that, not just as a, oh, nice idea, I like that, but to actually embody that fact and then live out of it, we calm the waves of the mind, but really of sense experience itself. But most importantly, the mind. That's where the confusion is centered. Seeing is not such a problem, but when seeing gets wrapped up with our evaluations and thinking, then you know where it goes, right? Hearing is pretty pure, just listening to music, but we can also take that and dislike it or like it, evaluate it, judge it. So it's apparent, it's clear in all of the senses, but the locus, relatively speaking, is this mind with its thoughts, likes and dislikes. So by actually letting that mind movement come fully to rest, letting the train of mind come to a full and complete stop, letting the waves become calm so the water is clear right to the bottom. Well, you can't help but see it. The pearl was there all along. Yeah, that's right. It was there all along. How could you miss it? How could you not see it? But practically speaking, as a process, it's very helpful to calm the waves. That's why we do what we do here. I'll read that paragraph again. This is the most urgent task. If you don't practice calmly and quietly, in the end, you'll be completely lost. To search for the pearl, it's best to calm the waves with the water of concentration still and clear. The mind pearl reveals itself. Please feel free to stand up and stretch for a moment. Thus, the Perfect Enlightenment Sutra says that unhindered and pure wisdom all arise from jhana. The Lotus Sutra says that in a quiet place, one should cultivate the mind and let it settle so that it is as still as Mount Sumeru. Thus, to transcend secular and sacred, the worldly and the holy, quiet meditation is necessary. To freely pass away sitting or standing is dependent on the concentrated power of dhyana. Again, he refers to the sutras and the authority of old, comes up with some quotes that were probably important back then, long forgotten now. The last sentence, we have come across a similar notion before. In the exhortations for those who do arouse the doubt, Bhoshan gives this extraordinary tale he just briefly mentions of a monk who actually passed away, died, that means to pass away, to die sitting in meditation, which at times was a very common thing to do, to show that you had resolved the one great matter and were at peace even in life and death. The monk would, he would know that he was about to die, maybe write a poem off, and they would write a death poem, make sure that their affairs were in order, and then die in zazen. Perhaps because that became so common, some monks decided to pass away standing up. See, I'm not even attached to sitting. Yeah? Pretty good, huh? So, for example, the founder of Myoshinji, the monastery I first lived in when I went to Japan, he, legend has it, came out of his, now it's a temple, but back then it was probably little more than a hut, and told his assistant to get his walking staff and his sandals, the sandals that you go out on pilgrimage, put them on, held his staff in his hand, and then he died. He was going on his final journey. So what is being said here is to freely pass away sitting or standing is dependent on the concentrated power of dhyana. Again, in the exhortations for those who do rouse the doubt, there's this bizarre story of a master who passes away and the two senior monks are discussing which one will take over. And the one of them gets upset because he's been told he doesn't really understand his master's teaching. So he gets so upset that he gets a piece of incense, a stick of incense, and says, burn that stick of incense. And if I can't die before this stick of incense finishes, then I will accept that you're right, that I don't understand my teacher. Anyway, the stick of incense is lit. And sure enough, through his tremendous power of dhyana or whatever, according to the record, he died before the stick of incense finished. The point of the story, of course, is that the other senior monk who had challenged him then taps him on the shoulder and says, you may know how to pass away while sitting or standing, but as for our teacher's teaching, you don't have a friggin' clue. And the amazing thing is this is right in the beginning of the Soto Zen tradition. So obviously they already were well aware of that danger of being attached to simply sitting in meditation. But this was a case where this sitting or standing, this is a set phrase, sitting or standing and passing away had become something it shouldn't be. But here, what he's simply saying is, if you're able to give yourself to that concentrated power of dhyana, then things become very clear. And birth, life, death, yeah, no big deal. If it's not, then you're dreaming. If your practice is not free even in death, then you're dreaming. Not trying to rationalize. Yeah, well, there's, you know, there's birth and there's death, and so, you know, I lived a good life and now I'm going to die. That has nothing to do with it. Death itself is calm. If death itself is not calm, then you are not calm, are you? So please don't get wrapped up in mind states and slowing down the train. Death is coming. For the self, it's inevitable. Death is coming. Buddhism speaks of the unborn for a very good reason. But you can't think yourself to it. Again. Thus, the Perfect Enlightenment Sutra says that unhindered and pure wisdom all arise from dhyana. The Lotus Sutra says that in a quiet place, one should cultivate the mind and let it settle, so that it is as still as Mount Sumeru. Thus, to transcend secular and sacred, quiet meditation is necessary. To freely pass away sitting or standing is dependent on the concentrated power of dhyana. So you see the great value of what we are doing here. No, it's not the answer to everything, but it's a very good way to enter sustained practice and see your practice through. Even if you devote your life to it, to the practice, be wary, be aware, be careful of falling short of not really resolving the one great matter. To begin again, even if you devote your life to it, be wary of falling short. And if you waste your time, how in the world will you overcome your karmic hindrances? Thus, an ancient has said that without the concentrated power of dhyana, you will cower, be very afraid, at death's door. With eyes covered, you end your life in vain, like a vagabond. In other words, you've wasted your life like someone who doesn't know where their home is, a vagabond, a beggar, a wanderer. In other words, who hasn't been able to come home. Even if you devote your life to it, be wary of falling short. It's powerful, but it's effective. What we have been doing the last few days is not so different. There's over 10 of you here, I think, who have sat session at Tofukuchi, huh? Good, I think one-third of us, or one-fourth of us, I should say, one-fourth of us have actually been in a real training monastery and spent time there training, huh? So you have a sense of what it's like to really just give all of yourself in a very rigorous monastic practice, huh? How different is it from what we have been doing the last few days? Alex, you were there, I think, most recently. Huh? Pretty much the same? The floor is a little bit different. Huh?
Yeah, it's more comfortable here.
It's more comfortable here. About the only major difference I see is that you have a room to go back to. Maybe it's a shared room, but you have a room to go back and rest. They don't. This is their room. This is where they live. When they take a break, right? It's this. When they sleep, well, there's a slightly bigger one that they roll out and they sleep right here. And then they put it away and they sit. They live here. They take their break here. They don't go to the bathroom here, but pretty much everything else. During the rohatsu, they even eat here, but usually they go to the dining hall to eat. Minor difference, but consider it well, huh? basically what you're doing, that amount of practice, you know, it's a little more rigorous, huh? We walk a little faster. But it's basically the same thing, except they don't have that room to go back to. They live here. No, we don't have to imitate that. But we do have to take the essence of what they're doing and bring it to life in our lay life, in the world that we do. That's why we have this retreat. Consider it well when you go back to your room to rest. They, even the monks rest, they take breaks, they sleep. But it can be done, it should be done in a way that continues, contributes to the practice so that it really becomes continuous, so that you can really see it through to the end and not just turn it into another dream that you had. And if you waste your time, how in the world will you overcome your karmic hindrances? Again, very practical. Huh? We all have our past, our karmic hindrances, a general term for what we have to work through. Huh? Those things, in a sense, can just disappear, but often we need to work through them. We need to be aware of them and work through them. The things that have become great challenges or great disappointments or even great successes to us can sometimes come back and haunt us, can become something that controls us. So it's necessary to work through, to overcome that. And as he's saying, if you waste your time, you're not even going to be able to do that, let alone really be able to see through. So please do make best use of this precious opportunity. We have a good 24 hours left. It's plenty of time if you use it well. I'll read that paragraph again. Even if you devote your life to it, be wary of falling short. And if you waste your time, how in the world will you overcome your karmic hindrances? Thus, an ancient has said that without the concentrated power of dhyana, you will cower at death's door. With eyes covered, you end your life in vain, like a vagabond. This is in contrast to the end of the last paragraph, where he said, to be able to pass away freely sitting or standing up, huh? Now the image is, oh no. The end. Fortunate Dharma friends, please read this manual again and again for the benefit of oneself as well as others. Let us all together fully awaken. So fortunate, Dharma friends, he's reminding us of how fortunate we are to be able to be here, in his case, whatever kind of a community they had, but here, now, to have this sangha, this community of like-minded people practicing together, supporting, being supported by each other. You've all, in the last few days, experienced what that is like, huh? It's a tremendous asset, help in our practice. Of course, we have to do the real work, each one of us, ourselves. The karmic hindrances are ours and ours only. But to do it together in a group, is a great virtue. You have all, I trust, experienced that in these last few days. Largely in silence, but still a great support. And most importantly, experiencing the ground itself, supporting us in our practice. All of the, as it said, causes and conditions coming together so that we can be here for days and give ourselves to the practice. We are indeed fortunate Dharma friends, as he calls us. Please read this manual again and again. I don't know, maybe he gets some profit on it, copyright. Each time you read it, he gets a couple cents. For the benefit of oneself as well as others, going back to the very beginning, right? Not just for yourself. For the benefit of oneself as well as others, let us all together fully awaken. Does anyone have a question or a concern? Maybe something you didn't understand or you want to check about the Zazen manual first? Yes?
I wonder about what you said yesterday about using your hara. You can misuse the
yes.
technique. What do you mean exactly by that?
Well, as you know, because again, you've been there, huh? The Hermitage in Kyoto. Many people that come to the Hermitage have practiced in other places in Japan. And I think it's especially a problem with the Japanese Zen, especially Japanese Rinzai Zen practice. Some places really focus on the hara, and they turn it into what I call hara Zen. And so they become, frankly, neurotic, and they just are obsessing about it. And for example, their teacher is very good at it, so they feel they're not able to do it right. And unless you can really breathe from the hara really, really good, you can't do koan practice. Oh no, I'll never get enlightened.
So, doing that self, is that a bad thing, you think? Using that technique itself, is that harmful or bad?
I would say if you use it properly, it's very good. That's why I'm trying to just speak about it in more general terms and not turn it into an obsession. To get out of your head, it's very valuable. But the problem is they then get stuck here. That's the problem. And I mean, I've seen it over and over and over again, or I wouldn't say this, but they come and they're just completely broken people. You know, instead of being able to practice, they feel that they've failed. They can't breathe right. And then they have headaches, they have stomach aches, and they're just, you know, It's very sad to see. So yeah, we have to be careful. It can become an obsession in itself, just like learning to sit and enter very, very calm and quiet states can become an obsession. This is an obsession. It's more with the pushing to have an enlightenment experience. Some places they'll even say, you know, in 6 months we want you to be able to have some kind of a kensho. And they really push it. And so, yeah, people have experiences, but it's just completely unintegrated. You know, they just become broken people. It's not a good way to do it. So that's some of the problems. I briefly mentioned it in a number of the lectures I've given over the last few years. Okay, Ari? Yeah. Any other? Yeah, you might mention, since you mentioned that, Ari, he only mentions really about the breath once, and he simply says, regulate breath, two characters, regulate breath. That's it. But over the centuries, for various reasons, part of it is an influence from Taoism, this kind of breathing has become, in certain schools of Rinzai Zen, a real hang-up. They've really gotten hung up on it. Huh? It is a danger. Thanks for mentioning it. Huh? Any other questions or concerns? Yes.
During my practice, I noticed that I'm longer in practice. I have a sensation between my eyes. So is that something that you can say something about it, or is it nothing? Or is it?
Yeah, I would just say let the energy flow down here. Don't worry about between the eyes, the forehead. Yeah, yeah. there are, you know, chakras.
Okay.
And people often have experiences at the top of the head, here, many things, but I wouldn't worry about it. If it happens, recognize it, see what it is, and then just let that energy flow down. You may even find it coming back up again and then flowing down. You don't have to do actively interfere with it. Be aware of it, but the focus is letting it get settled here, below the belt. Okay? See from here. Okay? No other questions or concerns? I've gotten to the end of the Zazen manual. I guess we'll just stop the retreat here and go home. Ron.
Just a
question.
Yeah. Sometimes
when
it looks like this one, right? Is this from the Rinzai or also from the Soto school?
This is before the two were even cleanly divided. I mean, there was the Lin Chi line already. Lin Chi had passed away about 200 years before this. But this is before Dogen lived. So in the Japanese tradition, it's irrelevant. This is a Chinese text. And again, it was by a Chan Chinese Zen monk. And this sense of Rinzai or Soto Zen, it doesn't exist in China to this day. You know, I went in Coletta retreat Christmas to New Year's. And what they do is they do Huato, koan practice, and they also do silent illumination, which is the basic Soto practice. So they've, in a sense, always been together in Chinese tradition. Also, the Pure Land practice of, you know, reciting the name Namu Amida Butsu is also very important there, although that's not in Japanese. And also, prostrations are really big. They do a lot of prostrations. It's much more devotional. It's much more devotional. But that division does not exist in Chinese Zen. So this guy was a monk. Technically, he was in the Lin Chi lineage, but it's not really relevant. As I mentioned, he was actually also a teacher in the Pure Land tradition, which makes it quite exceptional. Okay? There's at least one book written about this text, if you're interested, in English.
There was a passage about standing up slowly.
Yeah. Maintain the. Yeah.
Maybe this is a question for tomorrow. But I see how that works in a monastery. Mm-hmm. But how do you do that in everyday life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the real work. I mean, here, as hard as it is, it's easy. Going back to daily life and being able to sit maybe only for 20 minutes or 30 minutes and then get up and carry compromises, contradictions, assholes for bosses, you know, whatever, you name it. That's where it really, the shit hits the fan, do you think? That's where. But yeah, you have to stay till tomorrow for that, because but it's important. I would say I'm glad that you prefaced by saying maybe tomorrow, because yes, don't even think about it now, because that's something to think about tomorrow. That's what we do tomorrow. How to take this to the streets, taking it to the streets, huh? It's very important, but not yet. We still have about 24 hours left to have the luxury, in a sense, of not having to worry about that. We don't have to go back yet. So just give yourself to this practice, and then tomorrow I will take it up, and if I don't do it sufficiently, please raise the question again, okay? But I will tomorrow morning. Okay? Tomorrow I'll also reread the whole Zazen manual. It's only 2 pages, one more time. And then again, if you have any questions about it. And also go through what it is now to tomorrow, I mean tomorrow morning, to finish this and go back to that, how to do that, okay? It's an important question so that we can make use of what happened here without turning it into something, huh? Where's Dad? Oh, he's getting enlightened. There's a story in the Soto Zen in California when it was such a big thing and everybody was going to the retreats, and there's this girl, her dress is all undone and she's all muddy in front of the house, and the neighbor says, "Where's your mom? She's getting enlightened." Try not to fall into that trap.
Yeah, you can misunderstand this. Yeah, what's my point? It's it's a how many the most important task, and without obsessing about it.
Yeah. Well, what I find is if you're doing it properly, and you can just go back, you find yourself doing what needs to be done. Whereas ordinarily, we're so much up in our head and, oh, I don't want to do that, and oh, this person called me again, and you're all wrapped up. But when you go back from here, it's clear. It's not always pleasant. Everyone doesn't always agree with you. But you go back and you do what needs to be done without having to think about it. You're able to just do what needs to be done. This, some of you know, I don't want to mention any names, but a few years ago I did a retreat in the UK in England, and at the end one of the guys that I know had a pretty deep experience, and his wife was a medical doctor and not very supportive of him going off for several days and leaving the daughter and her alone. But he had a pretty strong experience. And as he explained, when he came home that night, his wife opened the door and said, "You're glowing." And after that, she doesn't mind him going to retreat so much. Matter of fact, sometimes when I go to England, I stay with them. And actually, she's a very nice woman. She's still not interested in Zazen, that's fine. But we have a very good time together. We have a very good time together. And she's not against her husband going to retreats anymore. The other guy is that had an experience during that experience is Kevin Gould. He's a food and wine critic for The Guardian. Very, very wonderful guy, but also a Sufi mystic. So he came to the retreat completely. He had never done a Zen retreat before, but boom, he was right there and really had a good experience. And as he told me, I just saw him a few weeks ago. This experience happened a while ago, but I saw him again a few weeks ago. He was saying, "I was driving home in my car," it was about an hour and a half from Surrey back to London, and he said, "I had the radio on and I was listening to my favorite football team, and they scored 3 points on the way home. I heard it on the radio. It was a blue sky in London. I was just, you know, and I get home and I can't find my house key. So I ring the bell and my 21-year-old daughter opens the door, takes one look at me and says, 'Gandhi's home.'" So, I trust that will help you tomorrow when you go. The funniest thing is the next retreat, his wife came and also did the retreat. And I was wondering if when they got home now, she said, "Mother Teresa's home." But yeah, this is something we'll take up tomorrow. Yeah. thank you for your questions, comments, jokes, and all. And again, we will continue tomorrow with this. It is essential. Otherwise, we've wasted what we've just been doing for the last few days. So we will go through that tomorrow. For now, please give yourself with the time left to what we have to do here. Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be doing this together.